Suddenly she tried to twist out of Shuya's hand. Shuya gripped tighter in response, but the blood dripping down from his neck suddenly made his hand slip. Yuko's hand left Shuya's. The weight on Shuya's arm suddenly vanished. Yuko's face receded. With a thud, Yuko fell on her back onto the roof of the single-story building below. Instead of slipping from his hand, she seemed to have appeared there suddenly via time-lapse photography. Her body, in her sailor shirt and pleated skirt, was sprawled out, and her neck was crooked, which made her head look at odds with the rest of her body. The top right side of her head spurted out a red substance in the shape of a shriveled-up maple leaf. Ah. Shuya stared down at her, his right arm still hanging over the balcony. 8 students remaining. Chapter 65. Hiroki Sugimura, male student number 11, took a deep breath. He'd heard the rapid gunfire approximately 10 minutes ago. He'd been wandering around the northern mountain, but he quickly headed east toward the shots. By the time he arrived, it was already quiet at the lighthouse. He knew it was there from the map, but he assumed Kayoko Kotohiki would never hide alone in such a conspicuous location, so he'd ignored it until now. He wasn't sure whether this was where the gunfire occurred. He looked down from the cliff over the lighthouse and saw a girl lying on the roof of the brick annex by the lighthouse. Even from a distance, he could make out the red color and see that she was dead. The short hair and petite body resembled Kotohiki, as had Megumi Ito's corpse when he discovered it. He slid down the edge of the cliff. As he descended, the corpse on the roof disappeared from view. He reached the front entrance of the lighthouse. There was a pile of chairs and desks beyond the open door. Someone had formed a barricade, but for some reason this barricade was also torn down. He looked at the window that was sealed shut with planks and cautiously walked down the hall. There was a room with a bed right by the entrance, and its door had been knocked down. His detector responded, 6. Hiroki proceeded cautiously and found himself in a room splattered with blood. The bodies of 5 girls were scattered across what appeared to be a kitchen. There was the female student representative, Yuki Utsumi, on her back by the center table. To her right was Haruka Tanizawa, her head nearly torn off. Farther down, Yuka Nakagawa, whose face had turned nearly black. Chisato Matsui was lying face down in front of the side table to his right. Her pale blue face turned his way. And then one more girl was lying face down behind the table, covered in blood. The 4 girls, including Yuki, were clearly dead. But this one, whose face he couldn't see, was... Hiroki cautiously checked the room once again. He listened for any sounds beyond the open door on the other side of the room. There didn't seem to be anyone else hiding. He tucked the gun in his left hand and back, walked between the bodies of Yuki Utsumi and Haruka Tanizawa, passed by Yuka Nakagawa's body, and walked around the table. The soles of his shoes splashed in the blood all over the floor. He crouched down beside the girl lying face down, put aside the stick in his right hand, and lifted her body. He felt a sharp pain from the wound in his right shoulder where Matsuko Sauma had struck him. The gunshot wound on his thigh, courtesy of Toshinori Oda, was only a scrape, so there wasn't much bleeding or pain there. Hiroki tried to ignore it. He turned over the body. It was Satomi Noda. There was a red hole in the left side of her forehead, and her glasses, though crooked, managed to stay on her face. The left lens probably shattered when she fell. Of course she was dead. Hiroki put her down and looked over at the open door on the far side of the room. That was where the tower was. That led up to the lantern room. The other person picked up by the detector was that girl on the roof. She was no doubt dead as well, but he had to check and make sure it wasn't Kayoko Kotohiki. Hiroki took his gun and entered through the door. There was a steel staircase. He quickly climbed them with hushed footsteps. Someone might still be up there. He held both the stick and radar in his right hand, checking it as he went up. There were no new responses as he came out into the lantern room. Hiroki put the radar in his pocket. tucked his gun back into his belt, and went out onto the balcony circling the lantern room. He put his hand on the steel railing. He took a deep breath, leaned over the railing, and looked down. There was the corpse in the sailor suit. Her neck was twisted and blood spread out from under her head. But the corpse wasn't Kayoko Kotohiki's. It was Yuko Sakaki. Still, he gazed at the sea. There was a strong breeze. 6 girls had all died here at once. There were no guns in the room, but given how they were wounded and how the walls and floors were ridden with bullet holes, he was certain the gunshots he'd heard had occurred here. The most logical scenario was that the girls somehow got together and cooped themselves up here, but then someone attacked them. The 5 girls were shot down there first, and then Yuko Sakaki managed to get this far and fell to her death without being attacked by the assailant. Then the assailant left before Hiroki got here. But given how they'd formed a barricade at the entrance, the planks nailed over the windows, every entry point probably sealed, why would they tear the barricade down? Did the assailant shove it away as he left? But then how could he or she have entered in the first place? Could there have been 7 of them, and one of them had suddenly betrayed the rest? No, revealed his or her true intentions? No, that couldn't be. The other thing was that Yuka Nakagawa didn't look like she died from gunshots. She looked like she'd been choked. The blood splattered all over the table also didn't make any sense. How could that large amount of blood end up there? There was more. The door to that room right next to the entrance. Why had it been shattered? There was no use trying to figure it out. Hiroki shook his head, checked the roof of the building, and returned to the lantern room. As he descended the steel spiral staircase in the dim tower and gazed at the inner walls of the lighthouse, Hiroki felt a light sensation of vertigo, as if the spiral movement of the stairs were internalized. It might have been from fatigue, but still. So now there were 6 fewer students. Sakamochi said there were 14 students left as of the noon announcement. Then there were at most 8 students left now. Was Kayoko Kotohiki still alive? Wasn't it possible she might have died between noon and now in some area he didn't know about? No, Hiroki thought. She has to be alive. Even though he could hardly justify it, for some reason he was nearly certain. 8 students remaining, possibly even fewer. But I'm alive, and so must be Kotohiki. This is taking too much time. It's been a day and a half since the game began, and I still haven't managed to find Kotohiki. But I will, eventually. Once again, he was nearly certain. Then he thought of Shuya's trio. None of their 3 names had been announced. Shogo Kawada had said, "If you're up for it, you can come aboard our train." Was there really a way out? And would he really be able to reach that station with Kotohiki? He wasn't sure, but at the very least he wanted Kotohiki to board that train. "Shall I offer you a hand then, mademoiselle?" It sounded like something Shinji Mamura would have said. Now he saw how Shinji could be good friends with Yutaka Sito. Shinji liked to kid around. His jokes were different from Yutaka's, of course. They were more sarcastic and at times biting. Shinji seemed to value the importance of laughing it off. At the closing ceremony before New Year's, when they were in their 2nd year, during the regional education representative's dull speech, Shinji said, "My uncle once said laughter is essential to maintain harmony, and that that might be our only release. Do you understand that, Hiroki?" "I still can't quite get it," although he could relate to it a little. He also felt he didn't fully get it. It might have been because he was young. But in any case, Shinji Mamura and Yutaka Sito were both dead now. He could no longer give Shinji a reply. As he pondered these thoughts, soon enough he was back in the kitchen filled with 5 bodies. Once again, Hiroki looked over the room covered in blood. He hadn't noticed because of the stench, but now he saw the gas stove and pot and caught a whiff of the appetizing aroma. There was no gas, of course, so they were probably in the middle of cooking using solid fuel. He went to take a look. The flame under the pot was out, but there was still steam rising from what looked like stew. Ever since the game began, he'd only had the bread the government had supplied. When he ran out of water, he retrieved some from a house well. So he was famished. But he shook his head and peeled his eyes off the pot. He just couldn't bring himself to eat it. Not in this terrible room. Besides, he had to hurry and find Kotohiki. Hurry up and leave. He staggered out into the hall. Not having slept at all, he was feeling dizzy. Someone was standing at the entrance at the far end of the long corridor. Because the hall was dim, this person looked like a silhouette outlined from behind by the light. Hiroki leapt to his side before his eyes could even open wide and crashed his way into the kitchen. All at the same time, flames came bursting from the silhouette's hands. A row of bullets raced past the tips of Hiroki's feet as they were flying out of the hall. Hiroki grimaced from the sudden surprise. He got up, crouched, and then closed the door and locked it. The gunfire sounded familiar. It was the sound he'd heard before and after that incredible explosion. After he escaped Toshinori Oda, he heard the sound of gunfire behind him. It was whatever killed Toshinori Oda. It was also the gunfire he'd heard when Yumiko Kusaka and Yukiko Katano were killed. He'd heard it several other times. It all came from that classmate. Like Hiroki, the assailant had probably come here after hearing gunfire. Or maybe the student was here to kill the assailant who'd killed Yuki Utsumi's group. Or maybe he had killed the group and was returning to pick off anyone else who may have been attracted to the noise. Kneeling down on the floor, Hiroki reached around his back and gripped his gun with his left hand. He'd found the bullets in the day pack Mitsuko left behind, so it was now fully loaded. But he couldn't find an extra magazine. Maybe Mitsuko had put it in her pocket. Colt Government 45 single action automatic. 7 rounds in the magazine, plus 1 in the chamber. He couldn't afford to reload the bullets individually. The moment he did, he'd be wasted by the assailant's machine gun. His back against the wall, Hiroki looked at the kitchen where the girls' corpses were. Unfortunately, the windows were sealed with planks from the inside. It would take too much time to tear them off and escape. He looked over at the door leading to the tower. No, that was impossible. It was too high for him to jump off the top of the lighthouse. It would be insane. He'd end up sunbathing right next to Yuko Sakaki. No, wait. What was this someone trying to do? Was he tiptoeing behind the door, approaching, or was he taking his time, waiting for Hiroki to come out? No, he had to be in a rush, too. He had to get rid of Hiroki before he might be shot from behind by someone else arriving as a result of the gunfire. Hiroki was right. The wood around the doorknob was blown to bits. In fact, several of the bullets exiting the door tore off the shoulder and side of Chisato Matsui, who was lying directly in front of the door. The door crashed open. The dark figure leaped into the room. As the assailant tumbled over once and got up, Hiroki realized it was Kazuo Kiriyama, male student number 6. Ignoring the corpses in the room, he pointed his machine gun to the side of the door, his blind spot, and immediately began firing away. After 5 or 6 bullets tore through the wall, the gunfire stopped, because he saw no one there. Now was his chance. Hiroki swung his stick up and leaped onto Kazuo Kiriyama from above. At the last instant, he decided to climb to the top of the high shelf installed beside the door. He decided against using the gun since he wasn't used to it and had tucked it away again. The important thing was to stop the assailant, who turned out to be Kazuo Kiriyama, from shooting anymore. Kazuo responded by looking up. He lifted the muzzle of his machine gun, but the handle of the broom Hiroki held struck Kazuo's wrist. The Ingram M109mm crashed onto the floor, slid, and stopped beyond the table where Satomi Noda was. Kazuo tried to pull out another gun. It was a large automatic pistol, different from the revolver Toshinori Oda had. But Hiroki, who'd landed and balanced himself, quickly swung the tip of his stick and struck this gun down too. A rapid assault. I'll strike him down. The stick came swinging down, but Kazuo quickly bent back and somersaulted backwards. He leaped over Yuki Utsumi's body with the grace of a kung fu master, and after tumbling once, he was standing in front of the center table. By the time he was standing, he had a revolver in his right hand, the one that belonged to Toshinori Oda. But even Kazuo couldn't have foreseen Hiroki's agility. He'd immediately moved within 80 centimeters of Kazuo. Ya! Hiroki swung his stick, striking the gun in Kazuo's hand 3 times. It flew through the air. Before it landed on the floor, the other end of Hiroki's stick swung at Kazuo's face. There was a table behind Kazuo. He couldn't retreat anymore. But the stick stopped several centimeters before hitting Kazuo's face and cracked in half. Kazuo had chopped off the stick with his left hand. The next moment, Kazuo formed a spear fist with his right hand to strike Hiroki in the face. He aimed for Hiroki's eyes. It was a miracle Hiroki managed to duck and dodge it. That was how fast Kazuo's fist was. But Hiroki managed to dodge, drop the stump of the stick, and grab Kazuo's wrist. The next moment, he twisted his wrist back. Simultaneously, he kneed Kazuo in the stomach with all his might. The absolutely calm Kazuo gasped slightly. With his left hand restraining Kazuo's arm, Hiroki pulled out his gun and cocked the hammer back. He pressed the gun against Kazuo's stomach and pulled the trigger. He kept on pulling the trigger until he used up all his bullets. With every shot, Kazuo's body flinched. When the gun's breech block held up, the 8th shell fell onto the floor with a clink, rolled, and then clicked against another shell. He could feel Kazuo's right arm and the rest of his body slowly going limp. His slicked back hair and the rest of his head fell forward. Once Hiroki let go, Kazuo's body would slide against the corner of the table and fall onto the floor. But right now, Hiroki stood still facing Kazuo as if dancing a strange dance, panting, his chest heaving. I won. He won against the Kazuo Kuriyama. The Kazuo Kuriyama, whose athletic prowess was probably superior to Shinji Mamura's or Shuya Nanahara's, who'd never lost a fight as far as he knew. He defeated him. I defeated... Suddenly a sharp pain pierced the right side of Hiroki's stomach. He groaned, gasped, then opened his eyes wide. Kazuo was looking up at Hiroki, and in his left hand was a knife digging into Hiroki's stomach. Hiroki slowly shifted his eyes from this hand over to Kazuo's face. Kazuo stared back with eyes that were, as always, beautiful and cold. How could he still be alive? Of course, it was because Kazuo Kuriyama was wearing Toshinori Oda's bulletproof vest. But Hiroki couldn't have known, and right now there wasn't much point trying to figure this out. Kazuo twisted the knife and Hiroki moaned. His left hand's grip on Kazuo's right wrist was loosening. Oh no, this is not good. At all. But Hiroki managed to squeeze some strength out into his arm. He swung down his right hand that was still holding the emptied gun. His bent right elbow struck Kazuo's lower chin. Kazuo flew back and slid across the white table covered with blood. The bloodstain that had resembled the Republic of Greater East Asia's national flag now looked more like the stripes of the American flag. Simultaneously, the knife in Hiroki's stomach, after tearing off approximately 30 grams of Hiroki's flesh, was torn out. Blood came bursting from the wound. Hiroki gasped, but immediately turned on his heels and ran to the door leading out to the hall. Right as he was entering it, he heard gunfire, and the doorframe cracked open. Kazuo didn't have any time to pick up the gun scattered on the floor, so he must have had a fourth gun, probably attached under his pants, tied to his ankle or something. Hiroki ran, ignoring the gunfire. He leaped over the scattered pile of chairs and desks. Right before he emerged outside, he heard that all-too-familiar machine gun fire, but the shots missed him because he was crouched over. The sky was cloudy enough to expect rain, but for some reason it looked bright to him. Hiroki ran as fast as he could into the grove beyond the gate where the light truck was parked. He left behind a trail of red spots on the white sand. He heard the machine gun rattle again, but by then he'd thrown himself into the grove. Of course, he couldn't afford to rest now. 8 students remaining. Chapter 66. It began to drizzle. Rain washed over the bushes covering the island, and in the dim light, a dark sheen fell through the drops of water and thick clouds. Shuya slowly wove his way through the bushes. The area to his right was open and offered him a view of the sea. which was dull gray behind the white curtain of rain. He now wore his shirt, school coat, and sneakers, which he found in the room where Yuki's group was. Raindrops falling off tree branches dripped onto his coat. He had the Uzi slung over his shoulder, his right hand on the grip, and kept the CZ-75 tucked in front. The Browning and the bullets he'd collected were inside the day pack on his shoulder. Shuya left the lighthouse immediately, and 15 minutes later, right as he began collecting wood to build a fire on a cliff near the northern tip of the island, he heard gunfire coming from the lighthouse. He surmised at least 2 students had arrived upon hearing the shots and ended up fighting. After some hesitation, Shuya started heading back. It sounded like the all-too-familiar gunfire of Kazuo Kiriyama's machine gun. He doubted Noriko and Shogo would go out of their way to follow the gunfire, but there weren't too many students left. Supposing one was Kazuo, there was a good chance the other was Hiroki Sugimura. Of course, it also could have been Mitsuko Sauma. But the gunfire ceased immediately. Shuya stopped. He decided not to return to the lighthouse after all. Even if he went back, there wouldn't be anyone there. Or at best, there might be another corpse in addition to the bodies of Yuki's group. It began raining when Shuya had finished preparing 2 fires on the cliff rock. He found a lighter in the lighthouse, but it was difficult to get the fire going because of the rain. The rain grew heavy, so Shuya gave up and left the area. Noriko and Shogo probably hadn't moved much. C3 was forbidden, but the adjacent D3 and C4 were still safe. They were probably in that area, so he could make another fire once he was in the vicinity. With this thought in his mind, he began walking. As he turned westward on the north shore of the island at 2:30 p.m., he heard the distant chirping sound of a bird. Shuya listened closely and quickly glanced down at his watch. The second hand moved 7 degrees, and the faint chirping stopped. Shogo had said 15 seconds. Given the time it took for him to look at his watch, its duration corresponded to that length of time. Besides, he doubted there were many birds chirping in the rain. And he'd not heard that peculiar bird call on the island at all before now. Shuya continued along the northwest shore of the island, and once again heard the same chirping. This time it was clear. Exactly 15 minutes had elapsed since the last one, and it stopped exactly 15 seconds later. It was Shogo. There was no need for the smoke signal. Shogo was using the bird call. It sounded close. According to the map, Shuya was moving from B6 to B5. Shuya rested a little, tucked the Uzi's barrel under his left wrist, and lifted his left arm. It was easier that way because he didn't have to exert his muscles. The watch hands, out of focus from the raindrops against the glass, indicated it was 3:05 p.m. The chirping sounded closer to the mountain than it was to the sea. Shuya glanced at the sea and moved toward and then up the gentle slope. As he looked up, he noticed that the northern mountain in front of him looked different, which made him realize he'd been moving along the foot of the mountain and was now approaching the western shore. Just a little more. He barely covered 1.5 kilometers, but he still felt woozy from all the blood he'd lost. The pain in his body was so severe he felt like throwing up. He really had to stop and rest. But he was almost there. Almost. He made his way through the grove and his fatigue became overwhelming. Of course he could be attacked at any point from the bushes, but he couldn't afford to worry about that. If that happened, he would just have to pull the trigger of the Uzi. The low bushes grew sparse and then were cut off. Shuya stood still. It wasn't as if there was someone holding a gun, but there was something strange in this narrow opening. At first it looked like 2 stiff gray clumps to Shuya. On top of that, they seemed to be moving. He stared at them. There were black pants and sneakers poking out of these 2 clumps. He realized they were corpses. 2 boys had died here. A flash of red color flew up from the stiff gray clump and cried, "Caw!" It was a large, heron-sized bird, its head drenched in red. The birds were feeding on the corpses. Shuya reflexively raised his Uzi at them. He put his finger against the trigger. but decided against it. He walked over. The birds flapped their wings and flew away from the two corpses. Shuya stood still in the rain by them and lifted his right hand up to his mouth. He felt a sudden urge to vomit. It was a chilling sight. The birds had picked away at their exposed faces. Their red flesh broke out of their skin. They were covered in blood. Shuya held back his nausea and somehow managed to look at them. He saw they were probably Tadakatsu Hatagami and Yuichiro Takiguchi. Then he noticed something about Tadakatsu's face, which was in worse condition than Yuichiro's. The birds weren't responsible for his deformed skull. His nose, unharmed by the birds, was also crushed. He looked around and found a bat lying on the grass. Even though it lay in the rain, the tip of the bat was still tinged with red. Given the state of Tadakatsu's face, he was most likely beaten to death with the gear of his sport, a baseball bat. Compared to him, Yuichiro's face was in relatively good shape. Of course, Shuya had a feeling his lips and eyeballs were gone by now. One of the birds landed on top of Tadakatsu's face. Then several more birds came by. Given how Shuya remained frozen, they probably assumed they were safe. Safe? You got to be kidding. Shuya once again put his finger on the trigger of the Uzi, but restrained himself. The important thing was for him to get back to Shogo and Riko. More birds reappeared. Were they feeding on the other bodies sprawled all over the island? Or was it just because they were near the sea? Peeling his eyes off the two corpses, Shuya staggered around them and entered the bushes ahead. He heard the birds cry, "Caw!" As he moved, he felt the urge to vomit once again. By now he was getting used to people dying, but the thought of these birds, these sky rats, feeding on them. "I'll never sit on the beach and gaze peacefully at seagulls again. Even if I write my own songs, I'll never ever sing about birds. I might not even be able to eat chicken for a while. Man, birds suck." But then he heard that chirping sound again. He looked up. Large raindrops hit his face. Birds suck, but I guess a little bird's all right, huh? Another full 15 seconds passed, and then the chirping ceased. This time it sounded really close. Shuya looked around. The bushes continued along the gentle slope. It must be around here. They had to be somewhere near here, but where? Before he could think, the nausea he'd held back surged up. The two corpses, their faces messed up. And their soft flesh would be the bird's afternoon snack. Yummy. "I can't puke. I'm weak enough as it is. But..." Shuya tripped and fell to the ground and vomited. Because he hadn't had anything to eat, it was all gastric juices. There was a sharp, acidic stench. Shuya threw up more. A pinkish substance was mixed into the yellow liquid like a drop of paint. For all he knew, his stomach might be screwed up by now. "Shuya." He looked up. Reflexively, he pointed the Uzi toward the voice, but the muzzle fell again. Between the shrubs, he saw that thuggish face. It was Shogo. In his left hand, Shogo held a bow he had carved out of wood, and in his right hand, he was about to put down the arrow fixed to the bow. That was when Shuya realized that he must have gotten caught in Shogo's tripwire. "Hangover, huh?" Shogo said. His humorous remark was tinged with kindness. There was a rustling sound. Noriko appeared behind Shogo. She gazed at Shuya through her rain-drenched hair, her eyes and mouth trembling. Pushing Shogo aside, Noriko dragged her leg as she ran to him. Shuya wiped his mouth and staggered up. He released the Uzi and extended only his right hand, hugging Noriko. On impact, Noriko's body sent a jolt of pain through his side, but he didn't care. They were having their reunion right above some fresh puke, but that didn't matter either. Her body against him felt warm in the cold rain. Noriko looked up. "Shuya? Shuya, I'm so glad. So glad." She was crying. Tears came streaming out of the corners of her eyes along with the raindrops falling against her face. Shuya gently smiled. Then he realized he was on the verge of crying too. Too many people had died in this game, but how wonderful, how incredibly wonderful that these two were still alive. Shogo came up to him and offered his right hand. For a moment, Shuya was puzzled by the gesture, but then he understood. He reached out his hand over Noriko's shoulder and held it. It was, as always, a large, solid hand. "Welcome back," Shogo said warmly. 8 students remaining. Chapter 67. Exposed rocks appeared where the woods headed toward the sea. Now a low wall formation of those rocks faced the sea. Shogo seemed to have worked on it with his knife. 2 large branches had been stuck into the rock wall, and on top of them were leafy branches serving as a roof to block the rain. Raindrops came flowing off the branch tips. After he was given strong painkillers that Shogo had brought from the medical clinic, Shuya told him about the lighthouse. Shogo boiled water in a can with charcoal, and its gurgling sound overlapped with the sound of pouring rain. When Shuya was done, Shogo said, "I see." He took a deep breath and put another wild 7 into his mouth. He held the Uzi in his lap. They decided it was best Shogo hold on to it. Shuya held the CZ-75, and Noriko had the Browning. Shuya shook his head feebly. It was awful. Shogo blew out some smoke and removed the cigarette from his mouth. Yuki forming such a large group ended up backfiring. Shuya nodded bitterly. "It's so hard to trust someone." "Yes, it is." Shogo looked down. "It's very hard." He continued smoking and appeared pensive. Then he said, "In any case, I'm glad you made it." Shuya recalled Yuki's face. He was alive. He was alive thanks to Yuki's group, but they were gone now. Shuya looked at Noriko on his left. Hearing about the deaths of her friends Yuki Utsumi and Haruka Tanizawa must have been hard on her. Once she saw the water boiling, she took out some dried bouillon Shogo must have found and tossed 2 cubes into the can. The smell of broth came drifting up. "Can you eat, Shuya?" Noriko asked. Shuya looked at Noriko and raised his brow. He knew he had to eat, but he had just thrown up. And besides, the images of the stiff gray lumps around Tadakatsu Hatagami and Yuichiro Takeguchi still flashed through his mind. He hadn't told them about that. The lumps were at work only 100 meters or so away from them. He only said that he threw up from the pain of his wounds. He couldn't work up an appetite. "Eat, Shuya. Noriko and I already had lunch," Shogo said, cigarette in mouth. His stubble had thickened. He grabbed the edge of the can with a handkerchief, poured the soup into a plastic cup, and offered it to Shuya. Shuya took it and slowly put it against his mouth. The taste of broth spread through his mouth. Then the warm liquid slid down his throat and into his stomach. It wasn't as bad as he'd expected. Noriko offered him bread. Shuya took a bite. Once he started chewing, he was surprised to find he could eat. He ended up eating it all instantly. Regardless of his mental state, Shuya's body had been starving. "Would you like more?" Noriko asked, and Shuya nodded. "A little more soup." He raised the empty cup. Noriko refilled it this time. Taking the cup, Shuya said, "Noriko." She looked up at him. "What is it? Are you feeling all right now?" "Uh-huh," she smiled. "I've been taking cold medicine. I'm fine." Shuya looked at the side of Shogo's face. Shogo nodded, cigarette dangling between his lips. He'd taken another antibiotic syringe kit from the medical clinic, but it turned out that was unnecessary. Shuya turned around to Noriko again and smiled back at her. "That's great." Then she asked the same question she'd been repeating over and over. "Shuya, are you really all right?" Shuya nodded. "I'm fine." In fact, he wasn't, but what else could he say? He could see over his cuffs how his left hand had grown pale compared to his right hand. He wasn't sure whether it was due to his shoulder wound or elbow wound, or it might simply be because the bandage was too tight around his elbow. He felt his left arm get stiffer and stiffer. He had another sip of the soup and put the cup down by his feet. Then he called Shogo. Shogo, who was checking the Uzi, raised his brow and looked at Shuya. "What is it?" "It's about Kazuo." As he contemplated the events that had occurred since yesterday, the question that had been occupying him right before he split up with Shogo and Noriko suddenly came back to him. The gunfire he'd heard right after he left the lighthouse also reminded him. As he'd yelled out before, "What the hell's he doing?" Meaning, what kind of person was Kazuo Kiriyama? As far as he could tell, Kazuo wasn't the only one willing to participate. Tatsumichi Oki, whom Shuya had fought, possibly Yoshio Akamatsu, and if Hiroki was right, Mitsuko Sama might also be in the same category. But Kazuo was absolutely merciless, calm and cool. The strange vibe he'd always gotten from Kazuo suddenly manifested in this game as pure psychosis. Shuya once again recalled the flames erupting from the machine gun and the cold eyes behind them. He felt a chill run down his spine. Shogo remained silent, so Shuya continued. What's up with him? I just don't get it. Shogo looked down and tinkered around with the Uzi's safety device, equipped with a full-auto, semi-auto switch. Didn't Shogo say there was no need to understand? Shuya wondered whether Shogo would give him the same reply. But Shogo had a different response this time. He looked up. "I've seen people like him before." "In the previous game?" "No." Shogo shook his head. "Not there. Totally outside of this game. You see a lot of things when you're the son of a doctor working in the slums." Shogo took out another cigarette and lit it. He exhaled and said, "A hollow man." "Hollow?" Noriko asked. "Yeah," Shogo nodded. "There's no place in his heart for principles or love. For any kind of values. That kind of person. On top of that, there's no reason for the way he is." "No reason?" Shuya thought. "Or did he mean he was just born that way? That's..." Shogo took a puff and exhaled. "Hiroki warned us about Mitsuko Sama, right?" Shuya and Noriko nodded. "We still haven't seen for ourselves whether Mitsuko is really up for this game. But from what little I've seen at school, I think Mitsuko and Kazuo are similar. The only difference is that Mitsuko's abandoned all reason and love. There was probably something behind that. I have no idea what it was, but Kazuo doesn't have any cause. The difference is crucial. There's no explanation behind Kazuo." Shuya stared at Shogo and mumbled, "That's scary." "Yeah, it's scary," Shogo agreed. "Just think about it. It's probably not even his fault. Of course you can say that about anyone, but in his case he probably could never grasp an unknown future. Nothing can be more terrifying than to be born that way. What I mean is that even a dumbass like me can think everything's pointless. Why do I get up and eat? It all ends up shit anyway. Why am I going to school and studying? Even if I happen to succeed, I'm going to die anyway. You wear nice clothes, you seek respect, you make a lot of money. But what's the point? It's all pointless. Of course, this kind of meaninglessness might suit this crappy nation. But, you see, we still have emotions like joy and happiness, right? They may not amount to much, but they fill up our emptiness. That's the only explanation I have. So these emotions are probably missing from Kazuo. He's got no foundation for values, so he merely chooses. He doesn't have a solid foundation. He just chooses as he goes. Like for this game, he might just as well have chosen not to participate, but he decided to. That's my little theory. He said all of this at once and then concluded, "Yeah, it is scary that someone could live a life like that, and that we have to take on someone like that right now." They fell silent. Shogo took one more drag from his shortened cigarette and then rubbed it out against the ground. Shuya took another sip from his cup of soup. Then he looked up at the cloudy sky over the edge of Shogo's thatched roof. "I wonder if Hiroki is all right. He'd mentioned the gunfire he heard after he left the lighthouse. He was still worried about it. "I'm sure he's all right," Noriko said. Shuyi looked at Shogo. "I wonder if we'll be able to see any smoke." Shogo nodded. "Don't worry. We can see smoke coming from anywhere on this island. I'll check periodically." Shuyi then remembered the bird call. It led him to them. But why did Shogo have such an odd thing to begin with? He was about to ask him when Noriko said, "I wonder if Hiroki met up with Kayoko Kotohiki." "If he did, we'd be seeing smoke," Shogo answered. Noriko nodded and then mumbled, "I wonder why he had to see Kotohiki." This had come up when they were in the medical clinic. Shuya's response was the same. "Beats me. They didn't seem all that close." But then Noriko said, "Oh," as if she'd realized something. Shuya looked up. "What?" "I don't know for sure." Noriko shook her head. "But maybe..." She emphasized her last vowel. Shuya knit his brows. "Maybe what?" "That would be..." Shogo interrupted them. Shuya looked over at him. Shogo was tearing the seal off a new pack of cigarettes and continued, his eyes glued to the pack. "Too corny in this fucking game." "But," Noriko continued, "it's Hiroki, so..." Shuya looked back and forth at them, utterly perplexed. 8 students remaining. Chapter 68. Kayoko Kotohiki, female student number 8, was hugging her knees in the bushes. She was on the southern slope of the northern mountain in sector E7. Evening was approaching, but the light coming through the bushes didn't change much. It just stayed dark. In the afternoon, the area was covered with thick clouds, and just 2 hours ago it finally began raining. Kayoko wrapped a handkerchief around her head to shield herself from the rain. Thanks to the branches over her, the rain didn't hit her directly, but her shoulders were drenched. She was cold, and of course, more importantly, she was terrified. Kayoko had first hidden on the eastern side of the northern mountain peak, in sector C8, so she witnessed Yumiko Kusaka and Yukiko Katano getting killed in front of her very own eyes. She held her breath. She knew that their killer was near, but she instinctively thought she would be risking more by moving. She stayed absolutely quiet. As noon and then night passed, she managed to avoid any attacks. She moved twice in accordance to the Forbidden Zone announcements. The second time she moved was immediately after noon today, because the southern side of the peak, Sector D7, was going to become forbidden at 1 p.m. So the northern mountain peak was now surrounded by 3 Forbidden Zones. Her allocated area was definitely shrinking. She hadn't met anyone yet. She heard a lot of gunfire, sometimes in the distance, sometimes nearby. She'd even heard an explosion but just remained still and absolutely quiet. The announcement every 6 hours made it clear, though. The number of her classmates was steadily diminishing. At noon, there were supposedly 14 remaining. And then there was more gunfire. Was it now just 12? Or 10? Since the beginning of the game, Kayoko had been clutching the pistol she had found in her survival pack. It was a Smith & Wesson M59 semi-automatic, manual included. But of course Kayoko couldn't have cared less about the gun's name. Kayoko put the heavy gun down by her feet and massaged the fingers of her right hand with her left. The muscles in her fingers had gone numb, and the palm of her hand was flushed red and imprinted with the pattern from the gun grip. She was completely exhausted, both from sleep deprivation and the threat of attack. Because she was too scared to enter a house that might be occupied, the only food she had eaten was the bread and water that came supplied with her day pack. She was hungry and thirsty. Her water intake was grossly inadequate. She did her best to save the supplied water and had drunk just a liter since the game began. If there was one good thing about the rain, it was that she could collect water by putting the recently emptied water bottle under a dripping branch. But it wasn't even a third full. She would intermittently remove the handkerchief from her head and wet her dry lips with it. But of course, this did nothing to relieve her dehydration. Kayoko let out a long, weary breath, combed back her short, shoulder-length hair, and took up the M59 again. She was in a daze. As she sat, dazed, she thought of that face again. She'd been thinking of that face ever since the game began. He wasn't as familiar as her parents and older sister, whom she thought of as well. But he was very important to her. She had just begun learning tea ceremony when she first saw him at an event conducted by the school where she attended tea ceremony class. It was the fall of her first year in junior high. Sponsored by a government park for an autumn holiday, the tea ceremony was held outdoors for tourists. The actual practitioners performing that day were all adults, so Kayoko and other students her age took care of menial tasks, like arranging outdoor seating and preparing biscuits. He was one of the masters of the tea ceremony. He arrived around noon. He was good-looking, but boyish, as if he were still a college student. Kayoko thought, "Oh, this guy must be helping out too." But he addressed Kayoko's teacher at her seat, saying, "I'm sorry I'm late," took her place, and prepared the tea. His preparation was very impressive. He handled the tea whisk and bowl incredibly gracefully, and his posture was impeccable. Despite his age, he didn't look odd in traditional clothes. Kayoko put her tasks on hold and was staring at him when someone tapped her on the shoulder. She turned around and saw her senior in the tea ceremony club at Shiroiwa Junior High, the one who'd invited her to attend the tea ceremony school. "He's pretty hot, huh? He's the grandson of the headmaster." "Well, to be more accurate, he's the master's mistress's grandson. I'm a fan too. I mean, basically, I've been going to tea ceremony class just to meet him." The senior informed her that when he was 19 years old and that when he graduated from high school, he was already ranked as an instructor with many disciples. Kayoko's only reaction at the time was, "Oh, he's from another world. So there's people like him." That was all. But then, she began spending more hours in front of the mirror whenever there was a tea ceremony school event, or whenever she knew he would be appearing as a guest in her class. Given her age, she didn't use makeup, but she did wear her traditional kimono immaculately, kept a comb in her hair, and carefully inserted her favorite dark blue hair clip. She had curved eyebrows, small curved eyes, a short, well-shaped nose, and wide lips that were nicely shaped at the center. Looking in the mirror, she thought, "Sure, I might not be stunning, but I do look pretty mature." The reason she fell head over heels for this man, who was adored by adolescent girls and middle-aged women alike, was pretty simple. After all, he was handsome and intelligent, cheerful and considerate. Basically, the kind of ideal man you hardly believe existed. On top of that, he apparently didn't even have a girlfriend. Kayoko had two important encounters with this man, although from someone else's perspective, they might not have seemed all that special. The first one occurred at the tea school's demonstration ceremony the spring she became a second-year junior high school student. The ceremony was held at the headmaster's home in Shirocho, near Shiroiwa-cho. Almost immediately after the event began, there was a problem. A special guest, the central government's regional cultural representative, suddenly began complaining about the tea ceremony. It wasn't the first time. There were government officials who announced their devotion to preserving the absolute sanctity of the nation, but many of them, in fact, abused their power. Some would even request kickbacks in return for arranging increased national traditional arts funding, which the headmaster would politely refuse. So this could have been a way to get back at him by stirring up trouble. The problem was that the headmaster was absent because he was hospitalized. The heir who substituted for the headmaster was so completely intimidated that his incompetence could have led to the school being shut down. But the 19-year-old master saved the day. He took the belligerent official to another room, then returned alone and said, "The official has left. He seems satisfied now, so there's no need to worry, everyone." He said no more, and the attending established members of the school also refrained from inquiring any further. As a result, the rest of the ceremony proceeded smoothly. But Kayoko was concerned. Knowing him, he could very well have assumed full responsibility, saying something like, "I am in charge of today's ceremony." And if that were true, then the official could get back at him by concocting a report and arranging his arrest for being a malign influence against the government, and as a result, sending him to one of those re-education camps. After the ceremony came to an end with no further interruptions, they began to clean up the area, and she waited for him to be alone. When he went to move the seat cushions, she decided to speak to him. "Sir?" He stopped, still holding the cushions, and elegantly turned around toward Kayoko. His sad eyes made Kayoko's heart race, but she managed to continue. "Is everything all right, sir?" He seemed to understand what she was getting at and broke into a smile. Then he said, "I appreciate your concern. It's all right, though." Her concern was suddenly eclipsed by the thrill she felt in having her first real conversation with him. But the government official looked so mean. What if..." He stopped Kayoko and said something sophisticated, as if admonishing her. "That official doesn't necessarily get a kick out of doing what he does. I'm sure this kind of thing happens all over the world, but the way this country is, it twists people. We're supposed to strive for harmony, and that's what the art of tea is supposed to accomplish. But harmony is very, very difficult to achieve in this country." Near the end, he almost seemed to be addressing himself. Then he looked back at Kayoko. "Tea ceremony is powerless, but it's also not such a bad thing either. You should enjoy it while you can." He smiled kindly, turned, and proceeded to walk away. Kayoko was in a daze and stood still for a while. The unpretentious way he talked made her feel at ease, and even though she didn't completely understand what he was saying, it impressed her, and she thought, "Wow, he's so mature." In any case, she thought she might have made an impression on him, because ever since that encounter, he would always give her a warm smile whenever they met. The second crucial encounter occurred during the winter of that year. Kayoko came out into the old temple garden of another tea ceremony and gazed at the camellia flowers there. In fact, she was thinking about him again. Suddenly, she heard someone behind her say, "They're beautiful," in a voice now familiar to her. At first, she thought she'd imagined it, but when she turned around, she couldn't believe he was there, and smiling at her, too. It was the first time he addressed her without any reference to teaching tea ceremony or official duties. And so they had a conversation. "So you find tea ceremony interesting?"
"Yes, I love it, but I'm not very good."
"Really? I've been impressed with your excellent posture during your preparation. It's not just that your back is upright. There's a kind of intensity."
"Oh, no, I'm really no good at all."
With his hands tucked inside his sleeves, he still wore his kind smile and glanced up at the camellia.
"No, I really do mean it. Yes, just like those flowers. There's something strained, but there is beauty in that." Something like that.
Of course, she was still just a child, and he might only have been complimenting a hobbyist dabbling in the school's tea ceremony. But that didn't stop her from getting excited.
"Right on!"
She snapped her fingers later in the bathroom. From that point on, Kayoko began to practice tea ceremony more seriously. She thought,
"I can do it. Of course, I'm still just a kid, but once I'm 18, he'll be 24. That would totally work."
And so that was her memory of him. Kayoko buried her face in her skirt. A warm liquid that wasn't rain oozed into the fabric covering her kneecaps. Kayoko realized she was crying. Her hand holding the gun trembled. How could all this be happening? She wanted so badly to see him now. Sure, she was still a kid. But in her own adolescent way, she really did love him. This was the first time she ever had serious feelings for someone. She wanted a single moment with him so she could tell him this much. She wanted to tell this person, kind enough to describe her as beautiful, even if it was only referring to her tea ceremony skills, "I'm still a kid, so I may not understand what it really means to be in love, but I think I am in love with you. I really love you.
something like that. Something rustled in the bushes. Kayoko looked up. She wiped her eyes with her left hand and got up. Her feet moved automatically and took a step back from the source of the sound. A boy in a school coat, Hiroki Sugimura, male student number 11. His face and torso emerged from the bushes. The sleeves of his coat and shirt were torn off, revealing his right arm. The white cloth wrapped around his shoulder was stained with blood and, perhaps because of the rain, it bled pink. And his hand was holding a gun. Hiroki's jaw dropped, but what really caught her attention when she saw his grimy face were his eyes. They were gleaming. Kayoko felt a sudden surge of fear. How could she not have noticed sooner, before he got this close? How? Kotohiki? Kayoko let out a shriek and turned on her heels. She entered the bushes. She didn't care about the branches scraping against her face and hair, or getting drenched in the rain. She just wanted to escape.
He'll kill me!
She made her way through the bushes. There was a twisting path approximately 2 meters wide. Kayoko instinctively decided to run down there. If she ran uphill, he would catch up. But if she ran down, then maybe. She heard a rustling sound behind her.
Kotohiki!
It was Hiroki's voice.
He's coming after me.
Kayoko summoned all her strength from her tired body and ran as fast as she could.
I can't believe this. I would have gone out for track instead of learning tea ceremony if I'd known this was going to happen.
Kotohiki, stop!
Kotohiki!
If she had been calmer, that is, if this were a scene in a movie and she were in the theater watching the actor performing as she munched on some popcorn, then it would have been obvious he was pleading with her. But right now, it sounded like he was saying,
Kotohiki, you better stop. I'm going to kill you.
She wasn't going to stop. The path forked. She took the left one. The area opened up on her left. Rows of tangerine trees spread out in the dull light coming through the silky rain. Beyond them was a thicket of short trees. If she could enter that area. But no, it was impossible. She had at least 50 more meters to cover. While she struggled through the uneven rows of tangerine trees, Hiroki Sugimura would catch up to her and shoot her from behind with his gun. Kayoko clenched her teeth. She didn't want to, but she had to. After all, he was trying to kill her. She stopped on her right foot and spun around to her left. By the time she had turned around, the gun was in her hands. That thing called the safety had been released ever since she'd read the manual. The manual said you didn't have to raise the hammer. All you had to do was pull the trigger. The rest was up to her. Less than 10 meters away, Hiroki Sugimura stood still on the slope, his eyes wide open.
It's too late. You think I won't shoot?
Kayoko extended her arms and squeezed the trigger. With a pop, a small flame exploded from the muzzle, and her arms jerked back from the recoil. Hiroki's large frame spun around as if he were hit. He fell back. Kayoko ran over to him. She had to finish him off so he wouldn't get back up again. Kayoko stopped approximately 2 meters away from him. There was a small hole in the left side of his chest. She'd actually aimed at his stomach, and the fabric around it had turned dark black. But his sprawled right hand still held the gun. He still might raise it.
The head. I have to aim for his head.
Hiroki turned his head around and looked at Kayoko. Kayoko pointed the gun and pulled the trigger. She stopped. Hiroki had tossed his gun aside. If he'd had that kind of strength, he could have pulled the trigger. What was going on? The gun spun around once and landed on its side.
Huh?
Kayoko stood still, holding the gun, her short hair drenched in the rain.
Now listen.
He lay on the messy path, ridden now with puddles as he said painfully, somehow fixing his eyes on Kayoko.
You have to burn some fresh wood. Build 2 fires. I have a lighter in my pocket. Use that. Then you'll hear a bird call.
Kayoko heard him, but she had no idea what he was talking about. She had no idea what was going on. Hiroki continued. Follow that bird call. Then you'll find Shuya Nanahara, Noriko Nakagawa, and Shogo Kawada. They'll help you. You got that?
What? Hiroki seemed to be smiling. He repeated patiently, "Build two fires, then find the bird call." He awkwardly moved his right arm, pulled out a small lighter from